That is set in terms of how we see them going into the final week of championship week. There's nothing that's going to change, Reese.
Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
Yeah, like my brother works with that Taco Bell.
Russ Dellinger.
I mean, he should de-furry himself.
And SI's Pat Forty.
I was just pleased to see Sir Big Spur up and about.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod presented by Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The penultimate rankings are out. The zombie tide live, perhaps.
Incredible.
Here are the rankings. Number one, Oregon. Number two, Texas. Number three, Penn State. Number four, Notre Dame. Number five, Georgia. Number six, Ohio State. Number seven, Tennessee. Number eight, SMU. Number nine, Indiana. Number 10, Boise State. Number 11, Alabama. Number 12, Miami, Florida. Number 13, Ole Miss. 14, South Carolina. 15, Arizona State. You shake this out through their little all the system with the auto bids, and that means Alabama would be the 11 seed in this situation and the final team to get in. Now, that is presuming a Boise State victory and all the favorites win. Arizona State would pop in presumably at the 12 spot as the Big 12 champ, and now they could also pass Boise State and get all the way to four. They could also jump Alabama at 11-2, and Alabama could be a 12 seed. I don't know. We'll see. But the main thing, if you are an Alabama fan, and 2 weeks ago after the Oklahoma game, you done buried them, the great legend on the Paul Feinbaum show, calling for Kalen DeBoer to be fired, said we're about national titles, we ain't doing this. The Crimson Tide fans buried him, but they weren't even dead. They could be back as the last team in this field. We'll get to all of that. Pat?
Yeah.
I think you got some thoughts on this.
I do.
Ole Miss and Miami have thoughts. I know that.
Yeah. Let's start with this. October 10th, 2024, Nashville. Sankey and Petiti, strong men sitting together at a table. Greg Sankey, quote, "This just has to go incredibly well." Talking about the playoff. It's now going incredibly well for the guy that rules the playoff. He's got Alabama over an ACC team for the second year in a row. We know what happened last year with them jumping Florida State. This year, it's Miami. Hurricanes lose by 4 points on the road against a 9-3 team. Plummet. Alabama, despite losing by 3 touchdowns on the road to a 6-6 team, Oklahoma, hangs around and gets in. Bama gets in. That's the way the playoff tends to work. 4-team, 12-team, doesn't matter. They've deserved it most of the time. I'm not sure they deserve this one. I can't cry a river for Miami here. I can't cry a river for anybody because I think we have basically 11 spots that are probably pretty well deserved and a 12 spot that is a bunch of flawed teams here. But I feel badly for Miami because I would have put them in ahead of Alabama. And I look at this and I say, the SEC gets what it wants and the Big Ten gets what it wants. And it's probably going to get even more that way going forward.
Woo. Yeah. This is pretty wild. Look, I'm speechless, Dan. I'm speechless.
Really?
The phone's been blowing up the last 10 minutes or so. Some angry people and some very happy people. Mm. Angry people from ACC country, happy people from SEC country, as you might expect. Alabama.
I don't know about all the SEC. Not all the SEC country.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. That's true. Ward Manuel basically saying that, yeah, the order of Alabama, Miami, Ole Miss, South Carolina is not going to change. Basically, as far as the at-large berth teams, is not going to change there. And the one big thing that right could happen this weekend, I think a couple of things could kind of shake up the rankings, but really there's one specific one, and that's Clemson, you know, upsetting and beating SMU in the ACC championship game. That would mean that Clemson would get the automatic berth, and they're not currently in the field, so they would be a bid stealer. They would steal a bubble team's bid, and the question would then be, does the committee put in SMU, the championship game runner-up, or Alabama, right? It would come down to SMU or Alabama in that situation. So that's really that in the Boise situation is really the only big shakeups. Boise could lose, and then that could shake up who gets the first round buys as well. But the tide rooting like hell for the ponies this weekend.
Yeah. So Ward Manuel said on ESPN, why Alabama over Miami? What it really came down to is Alabama is 3-1 against top 25 teams. Miami is 0-1. Alabama is 6-1 against teams over 500. Miami is 4-2. In evaluating their body of work, we felt Alabama got the edge over Miami. Not mentioned, Alabama has 2 losses against non-top 25 teams. Miami has 1. And Alabama has 2 losses to teams that are 500. Miami has 0. So it's kind of, do you want good wins or better losses for sake of say? This is not a.
He also said that Miami has lost 2 of its last 3, as if recency does matter, which I don't think is supposed to be the criteria.
They're
full
all
body
criteria.
Of work.
Well, yeah, that's true.
He mentioned
that was what South Carolina was going for. Like, look at how many games we won.
Yeah.
But their struggle is they lost to Alabama and Ole Miss. They're just stuck there. And I don't know that anyone would really argue that maybe South Carolina in the best of those 3, but does head-to-head matter? Well, I don't know. Like, apparently here it does. He also, as Ross said, and this is – I was a little surprised he said it, although it makes sense. There are no more data points here for these teams. So there is, quote, there is nothing that is going to change. So this is the order. If there is an at-large spot open, it's going to go to Alabama. If somehow 2 of them open, it would go Alabama, Miami. Now, also in this scenario where Clemson could jump in, he said, Clemson could jump in, ask him he could stay. He said, think about a couple years ago, TCU lost its championship game as the number 3 seed in the field and didn't move. It stayed at number 3. So SMU could absolutely stay in this field ahead of Alabama. The other one is Boise State. Could they stay in this field if they lose to UNLV in the Mountain West championship game? And I know everyone says, oh, no. It's the Mountain West championship game. No, it's a Mountain West. It's Group of 5, doesn't count. Their only losses would be very, very close to Oregon, at Oregon, and then a loss at home to UNLV, but a team they already defeated. They would not have 3 victories over top 25 teams. They would only have 1, I believe, which would be UNLV. But there is a philosophical argument that if you think this is the field after 12 games, then how can a team that doesn't play ever jump these teams if you make someone play an extra game? These other teams are not forced to play an extra game. That would also require Boise State losing and 2 Group of 5 teams, 2 Mountain West teams getting a bid.
Oh, my.
All of a sudden, the philosophy goes out the window because they just can't do But philosophically, if this is the field, then this should be the field other than the bid stealing jump-ins or seeding, because it's intellectually, it's not fair to say, go run another lap of the race while these other guys sit around and do nothing. But I would not count on that if I was Boise State. I'd go win that game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want the complete ACC meltdown, it would be if Alabama double trapdoors the league. If this happens, all right, they have trapdoored Miami. They have boxed out Miami. Miami cannot improve its position vis-a-vis Alabama. Clemson defeats SMU, but knocks out SMU instead of knocking out Alabama.
Yeah.
That would be the double trapdoor, and the ACC would lose its mind.
Yeah. Like, and it would be the same premise that Dan just said, right?
Yeah.
SMU is already in the field, right? You're going to make them play a 13th game. Shouldn't they still be in the field? And that's a good point with Boise, Dan. I really didn't think about it like that, but it's the same argument that ACC is using. You're in the field. Boise's in the field right now.
Yep.
So that would be pretty fascinating. Now, again, there are a little different circumstances, probably, right? SMU would be losing on a neutral field to Clemson. Boise would be losing at home to UNLV. I mean, it's an interesting point. That's certainly the worst nightmare, right, Pat, is Clemson really bludgeoning SMU by 2, 3, 4 touchdowns and SMU dropping behind Alabama and maybe behind Miami. I guess there's like some crazy way that Miami could get in still if SMU drop, you know, so far. Right?
Yeah.
I don't remember. They could.
No, because there can only be one spot at most can open.
No, that's true, because Clemson has to get in.
Clemson would get the spot. Even if UNLV beat, I guess you could have, who's the lowest ranked team playing this weekend? Georgia? Otherwise? So let's say Georgia lost to Texas like 222-0. Do you pop Georgia? I mean, it would take something crazy like that, right? Everything else. I'm a believer that if you think you should not get jumped by a team that's not playing. It's not that I'm not arguing that if Boise wins the championship, they move ahead of Alabama in the rankings. They're already ahead. You already think they're better. So why do they have to play a team they already defeated once on their field convincingly? Why do they have to pass that test and then have a team that's sitting around that has three losses potentially jump over them? So there is that, but that is out there. And so that could possibly happen. Do they stay in the field? But either way, that's not going to open up a spot. The only open up spot would be that ACC. I don't have a problem with two Mountain West teams if that's the scenario. But
it would be absolutely hilarious.
But I mean, you just said Boise's better. Why aren't they better if they lose a game? Pretty much this is our field. And then now a couple other scenarios here. Are you got anything else on that?
Nope. Go for it.
Tennessee is behind Ohio State. We will see how this shakes out. But at this point, the one of the big decisions, maybe even bigger than 12-4 on the group of five and the last conference champion, because you get a bye, but you're probably gonna have to play the five seed anyway. But the big decision is who's 8 and who's 9 in the field,
right?
Because that is a home game, and right now Ohio State has that edge over Tennessee. And as it shakes out right here, that means Ohio State hosts Tennessee. There are plenty of people in Tennessee, and they have a very, very good case that they should be 8 and Ohio State should be 9. And they should be ahead. So if it comes down to it, that is a monster decision. Is this game in the Horseshoe or is it in Neyland Stadium? Now, I would say this. Normally, this would be a massive advantage either way. I don't know that Ryan Day wants to play in Ohio Stadium again. He might want to go. He may want to go to Neyland. He might be like, yeah, can we just do this in Neyland? Can't they? If they don't want to host, they can pick like an NFL stadium.
Yeah, they can pick a neutral site.
He might pick SoFi Stadium.
He's going to pick SoFi. Get me away.
Get me the hell out of Columbus. But Tennessee has an excellent case that they should be ahead of Ohio State. Ohio State has the victories, has more victories because they beat Indiana and Penn State, but like of in the field where Tennessee would have a victory over Alabama, but a loss to Georgia.
I don't think Tennessee has a good enough case there. It's close.
It's close.
It's close.
They're making it. They're making an argument. Yeah, they're making an argument.
Penn State has better victories, and they both have a bad loss, but
Ohio State's
loss. Yeah, I'm sorry. Ohio State and Tennessee both have a bad loss.
Yep.
Ohio State's bad loss is not as bad as Tennessee's.
At home.
Ohio State's good loss is not as bad, or is better than Tennessee's good loss.
Is Michigan really better than Arkansas?
1 point
much?
At Oregon.
I guess a little.
I mean, I think so. Arkansas. Probably. I mean, that one's closer. I will say this. You lose by 1 point to Oregon on the road, or you lose by 14 to Georgia. Yeah.
This is
the
what
worst
it comes
loss
down
for
to.
Tennessee. But yeah, it's close. It's close.
Now, that could shake up. Again, Georgia could lose their fifth. They could lose and drop behind, technically behind Tennessee, even though they beat them. Or this could get reshuffled in some way. SMU could move up with a victory, right? Ohio State and Tennessee are stagnant. I don't know. Some different things can shift, but we're pretty close to what we got for all the tumult.
Yeah.
Like, we're down to Clemson steal a bid, and then I'm arguing philosophy based on Mountain West goodwill. Talk about a lost cause.
Yes. before Boise State jettisons the Mountain West to go to the new Pac-12.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's right. It's just their last year.
Yeah. No,
they got next year.
They have one
too,
more.
Right?
Yeah, they have one more. 26 is when they would start in the new Pac-12. Yeah.
Any other things shocking you in this field at all?
No, that's basically it. There was.
Do you think the Big 12 deserves more respect? I guess I don't know that it matters, but there certainly is not anything here that suggests, you know, I mean, the Big 12's top team is 16th or 15th.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not great.
No. The only other thing that stood out to me a little bit was just Syracuse is two spots behind UNLV. Syracuse beat UNLV in Vegas. You know, it seemed to me that Syracuse, thing is, you're coming into the rankings late. That this was, I don't think they were ranked prior to this week. So you're coming from behind as the committee is evaluating you. But I would have thought Syracuse might have been ahead of UNLV after breaking in there.
Notre Dame, pretty good chance at possibly being the 5 seed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think if Penn State loses to Oregon, then Penn State would probably be the 6 and Notre Dame's the 5. If Oregon loses, then Oregon's the 5 and Notre Dame's the 6, and Penn State maybe the 1, depending what Texas does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the home field seems pretty locked of Big Ten championship game loser, SEC championship game loser,
Notre
South
Dame.
Bend, and
Columbus. Right now.
Yep.
Right now. I mean, that's, that seems to be the case.
So if you're Tennessee.
Batters up, Pat. We're going to do double up. South Bend, Columbus, baby. That's what I was. Do a little double up, you know, because they're going to want Notre Dame on a night game. So we almost know that, right? Friday or Saturday night. No, Notre Dame is probably playing Friday or Saturday night.
Yeah, if we can get one on Friday night and the other on Saturday night.
And the other on Saturday, yeah. Yeah, maybe so.
Pretty awesome. So Tennessee, I've been predicting this home game the whole year. Tennessee gets the home play. I'm trying to figure, how can I make this work? I got like an abacus going here.
Yeah.
You need Penn State or Georgia to get blown out. That's what the Vol fans got to hope for here, because I don't see any other way up there.
Yeah.
One of them to drop behind you. Maybe Penn State's your better chance because
Georgia,
you did lose to Georgia.
You beat Tennessee. So
I will say,
like,
this isn't all going to hold the way it is, but ooh, we got some interesting first round matchups.
It's going to be good.
You're taking Arizona State out of sun-drenched Tempe and putting them in State College in December. You got Alabama at Notre Dame. Indiana, upstart Indiana between the hedges and Georgia, and then Tennessee at Ohio State. Oh my gosh.
We ruined college football. This is temporary.
The regular season doesn't matter enough anymore.
Every game mattered. Get out of here. All right, we're going to get to the rest of our show right after this. Time for some money moves presented by Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. You want money moves, gentlemen. Transfer portal opened Monday, and on Wednesday is the opening of the early national signing period, or whatever they're calling it. So money is going to officially be moving from lots of rich boosters to lots of players. Welcome to 2024. The most intriguing, it seems, is the situation surrounding the number one recruit in the country, high school recruit, Bryce Underwood, quarterback from Belleville, Michigan, and his recent flip from LSU to Michigan. He was committed to LSU for about 11 months, and this has been so exciting are so newsworthy that even the Wall Street Journal dipped into recruiting coverage, put on their rivals hat, and got involved with a lengthy story about the involvement of the second wealthiest man in the world, Larry Ellison, one-time founder of Oracle, and his apparent fifth wife, a 33-year-old woman named Karen Zhu, who also had a different name earlier. It's a very, very interesting story. This was first came out when the Michigan Collective, in a statement that they had agreed to terms with Bryce Underwood, which again is pretty funny. Forget the hat dance. mentioned Larry Ellison and his wife, which left many people unaware that he had a fifth wife. You lose count. I mean, that's a lot.
It can be hard to keep up when you get to that number, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not. I'm on your side, Larry. If you'd like to sponsor our podcast, we're available. Cheaper than Bryce Underwood. You could have. We'll talk great things about Michigan all day long if you'd like. We could have another whole podcast where we bash Ryan Day if you'd like. It's all there. We're all there. We too are buyable in the NIL era. You know that Oracle, it's a hell of a company.
There you go. That's, we can extol the virtues of Oracle since we're all very tech savvy.
We're about Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Anyway, there is a fifth wife. She used to be known as Jolyn. I don't know. Anyway, Jolyn, we'll call her Jolyn. Jolyn went to Michigan and was a student at the University of Michigan and is a big Michigan fan. Larry Ellison attended Illinois and then the University of Chicago before founding his companies. He didn't seem to be that big of a college football fan, but much like every other aggrieved Michigan fan who watched their quarterback play this year, was not happy with the situation. And she has the ability to do something about it. So along comes the second richest man in the world into the recruiting derby of the number one player in the world. And according to the full story out of the Wall Street Journal, who, to their credit, got Jay Underwood, the dad of Bryce Underwood, to talk, they started really a lengthy dialogue with Michigan starting back in September, which included a Zoom where the Underwoods were there having a video conference with Larry Ellison and his wife. And the Zoom, this is from the Wall Street Journal, the Zoom call, the billionaire recounted his upbringing on the south side of Chicago. He told Underwood that his birthplace didn't determine his station in life. So as long as he worked hard and made sacrifices, so long as he worked hard and made sacrifices. Jolyn spoke about her time as a Michigan student and her desire to put the Wolverines back on top. It wasn't really a pitch, Jay Underwood said. I find that billionaires, speaking to NFL owners occasionally, they don't really pitch you on anything. They just state things because everyone agrees with them. Mr. Ellison.
Uh-huh.
As I would, if you'd like to own a college football podcast. Just saying. Jolyn, We're here for you. Underwoods were a little surprised to discover that Ellison attended Illinois, but was now pulling for Michigan. This is the best quote in the line. Jay Underwood said, "I guess happy wife, happy life." I want to buy a quarterback. Go ahead, honey. What? How much? It's like $2 million. Whatever. Then they also had a call with Tom Brady. They were riding in the car, and the phone rang with a FaceTime. This is the funny part. Bryce Underwood said, "Dad, it's Tom." "Tom who?" Jay Underwood replied, "Tom Brady." "Well, expletive, answer the phone, son." That was, according to Jay Underwood, that was another incentive to be able to have the opportunity to talk to one of the greatest of all time on the daily whenever you feel like giving him a call. This was the recruitment. At the end of the day, Jay Underwood said, and the day they flipped. Now, there were all sorts of stories that Michigan was offering. First, it was $10 million. Then it was 10 and a half. Then I heard 12. Then I heard 14. It was going good. It was like South Florida real estate, baby. Things were popping. Jay Underwood, there's a lot of incentives, I was told. I don't know what to believe in any of these contracts. Could be 10, could be 14, could be four. I don't know. Jay Underwood.
Nice to see him.
It'd be great to see him. But if I was them, I wouldn't give him to him, Pat. You and the.
We're aware.
The deep state of the NCAA trying to get in on everyone's personal. Mm-hmm. Just show us your contract, Pat. Anyway, maybe when Mr. Ellison buys this podcast, we can have we'll it. Anyway, copy. Jay Underwood said the money offered by LSU and Michigan was, quote, pretty much even. Pretty much could be doing a lot of work there. I don't know. LSU's offer was widely reported to be $1.5 million per season, though in reality, neither school's collective offered as much as that, according to a person familiar with Underwood's recruitment. And at the end, he took a late visit to LSU, but then when he got back after the Belleville season ended, they decided to, his parents encouraged him to reconsider Michigan. It's about community, Jay said. It's about being playing close to home. At the end of the day, he flipped. Underwood is expected to get not just the money he receives directly from the collective and from Michigan, but also other deals. We know Barstool was selling T-shirts of him. Dave Portnoy is fired up on this. And, you know, there's the Dr. Who knows how good this kid's going to be. Jay Underwood said he expects his son's earning to exceed $15 million during his Michigan career. So some of that is what they call legit NIL, I guess. Direct pay for play, and then whatever this other NIL is getting. And so Bryce Underwood is headed. Very good reporting and story by Rachel Bachman, Lane Higgins, and Tom Dotton from the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, the era of the billionaire is officially in. We kind of have had him before, obviously.
We've only year four of the billionaire era.
Yeah, the billionaire era is in, but... Ross, your thoughts on this money move?
Well, to kind of to piggyback right there off some of the last things you talked about, which is the money figures. Some of the stuff I remember doing just some work in the immediate aftermath. Dan and I think both after this, just kind of finding out more details and maybe building a story or at least trying to learn more about what happened. And the immediate thing was that there's been no number out there that's been accurate, because you can't report a number because this is three different buckets of cash, and we don't know exactly, especially the third bucket, which I can get to in a minute to explain, is going to be. We don't know how much it's going to be. And so I think the numbers, which were all over the place, like we discussed earlier, I don't think anybody should believe the numbers as they've been reported. And the three buckets are, you know, you got a bucket of collective money coming in until July 1 when the rev share starts. You got the second bucket of rev share money from the school. And then you got the third bucket, which is like outside NIL from brands, companies, whatever, Barstool, you know, all that stuff. So this money through the course of his career could really change based certainly on that third bucket. The fascinating thing to me certainly is going to be the new police enforcement entity that the power leagues are creating, which is kind of a non-NCAA enforcement entity to police the rev share from the school and make sure schools are staying under the cap, but also monitor outside NIL to make sure these are real deals. And the clearinghouse, which will be run, I think, by Deloitte, is supposed to police all that and determine what's real and what's not. So they are assuming a lot. These schools that are promising a certain amount of money, I think, are just assuming, right, that they can get the outside NIL through the clearinghouse. Now, with someone like Bryce Underwood, a huge name, right, a Michigan boy, all that stuff, and you're going to a big brand, you're going to be able to generate a lot of outside NIL that probably can be proven as real. It's just fascinating, and I think we should look at the money figure as more a very fluid figure, knowing that there's these three buckets of money and how that's going to work going forward.
That's not fun, Ross.
It doesn't get the splashy headline.
I know, that's the thing.
Well, I have great confidence that an outside entity is going to come in and perfectly analyze and assess the NCAA rule book and apply those rules and work with the campuses and the compliance officers there, because it's already worked so well when we had the IARP that somehow like couldn't catch a bank robber standing in the bank with a ski mask on and a gun in his hand. So I think this is all going to work out fine, as NCAA enforcement tends to do when you outsource anything or even when you insource it. So I have high confidence in that. But this is fascinating, and it is the new world that is – I was talking to a coach yesterday, and they were happy that they were not on the road in December. You know, this is now a dead period, so they could at least stay on campus. But what they were doing was basically waiting for the front office that they've hired now, their front office people, to put offer sheets in front of their current players and have them say, you know, these are the terms of what we would expect to give you and the terms of what would you, we, you know, your employment with us, without calling it employment, for 2025. And are you going to take it, or are you hitting the portal and getting out? And that's kind of where they are. But then there's also signing day and signing period here. And we've got these massive deals for potential, you know, game-changing recruits, although there's been a lot of people who have been labeled game-changing recruits who did not change games very much. So that's the eternal kind of risk here. You know, was anybody willing to pay Ashton Jeanty $10 million coming out of high school? Nope. But he's been worth an awful lot at Boise State. You just don't know in recruiting. This guy may be the real deal. Bryce Underwood may be the next great quarterback. But we've heard that a lot of times about a lot of people.
Yeah, a couple things. I have seen Bryce Underwood play football, and he is very, 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 very good. But that's high school football. I would certainly look at him and say, yes, that's the number one recruit in the country, or somebody, there better be one, but one big timer that's beating him out. So he's terrific, but he's a high school player. How much is the NCAA spending on Deloitte?
That's a good question. And it's not the, it's really,
it ain't cheap.
We should stop ourselves from saying NCAA. This ain't the NCAA.
Okay, right?
This
well, whoever.
Is the power leagues. So how much are the power leagues spending? Okay. A lot, probably. I don't know. That hasn't come out yet. I think I'm the only one that had mentioned Deloitte. Hopefully that deal is done. I was told it was. I'm sure that it was between Deloitte and Price Waterhouse, and I'm sure that neither would have been cheap, Dan. So
used to laugh that they were so obsessed with players getting any money that they hired massive compliance offices to make sure they didn't get. They spent millions.
Oh, yeah.
to make sure players didn't get thousands. Right. We had, you know, I got an 8-man compliance department. It's the college sports industrial complex protecting itself to make sure. And it's like, well, why didn't you just take that money and just give it to the players, or do something else with it? We're broke. Well, that's because you're right? It's crackdown.
You've got a small army on one side of campus policing the bigger army that is the football staff on the other side of the campus. It was a great system.
Oh, they'd move them in the whole thing. The numbers, I don't know. Look, this is going to be considerable. It's what the kid's worth. How'd Michigan season go this season?
Right.
Not good. How'd LSU's go? Not good. Right? Like, the kid was worth a ton. The big number gets the headline, and it's fun. But, I mean, remember when the great journalist Sliced Bread reported.
Sliced Bread and Bro Bible and all that.
And Bro Bible, yeah. Sliced Bread and Bro Bible. Much like, you know, Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Very reputable reporter.
Yeah.
No.
Remember we had Sir Yacht, too. Sir Yacht.
That's right. This was the Jimbo, the A&M's original NIL figure.
Didn't Sir Yacht just say that the Big Ten was going to play after COVID?
Sir Yacht said,
and eventually you're going to be right.
He said like 20 different things about who was playing or not playing.
It's like reporting someone's going to die. Someone is dead. Yeah, eventually you will be correct. Right.
That's true.
Yeah.
That story, though, it kind of doomed Jimbo Fisher. $30 million on one single recruiting class. Now, we know 2 years later that Ohio State may have spent $20 million on an entire team, right? Entire team, including getting NFL players to return, cost maybe $20 million. Yet there was a lot of people just believed it and went with it.
Yeah,
$30 million for one recruiting class. So clearly that was not the case.
No,
but these things go, and it's actually a pressure on Bryce Underwood. They're going to pay $2 million bucks for kids out of the portal. Like, this is what the kid is worth it.
Yeah.
And I saw like Dick Vitale and a lot of people like, this was an absurd offer. And it's like, do the numbers, man. Like, they didn't have a quarterback this year and Michigan went 7-5. And how many, we're not going to, clip coupons for Michigan, but how many fewer, tickets that they, people showed up, how many fewer t-shirts, how many, like, you need a quarterback.
Yeah.
If he gets you to 10 wins, he's worth it. Easy.
Yeah. It's a deal. Spouse five could recognize the problem and say, hey, Larry, let's get going here. And I wonder, like, if he's that rich, if you're like, how big is her checkbook? She just, got carte blanche. If she needs $20 million for something. Yeah, fine.
Happy wife, happy life. Pat.
Yeah, right. Larry, I'd like to buy a house on the Amalfi Coast. All right, sure.
Yeah. I mean, if things that you're going to spend money on, this is not really that expensive.
Yeah, this is probably like a very small item on the ledger.
It's basically like I donated to the Boy Scouts. They're standing outside the grocery store for the rest of us. Like, what are you going to fight? You going to fight over that? No. All right, it's good. Right?
This is like Ross, the dude at SMU is like, $200 million is $200 million.
Huh? Yeah.
Whatever.
$200 million? What's $200 million?
It probably costs less than divorces 1 through 4.
Yeah, well, I guarantee it.
Actually, I shouldn't even. I'm sorry, Mr. Ellison. apologies for that. If you want to buy the podcast, just let us know. So there's that. This is what these guys are worth. But to your point, Pat, I'll just bring up this one in conclusion. Last year, one of the big your number one recruit, it could be Jeremiah Smith, right? Well, he was worth it. He's good. If you throw him the damn ball, Chip Kelly. What's that thing? Run the damn ball. No. Throw the ball to Smith. Last year, one of the big recruiting coups and was interesting part of the NIL discussion was when Texas Tech landed Micah Hudson. He was a 5-star recruit, wide receiver from Temple, Texas. And Temple, Texas has produced an absolute assembly line of great college and pro football players. If you come out of Temple, it's kind of why I believe Jeremiah Smith was going to be so good. Come out of South Florida and everyone down in Miami, you call anyone in Miami, like, oh, that dude. Right. They've seen dudes. They know a dude. Micah Hudson was that guy in Texas. He was, I think, 9th in the country on Rivals, stuff like that. Pure 5-star recruit. Not one of these borderline guys. True thing. He goes to Texas Tech. Huge recruiting coup for Joey McGuire, who has all these Texas high school ties. And obviously their collective got together and made it worth coming up there, whatever amount of money that was. Micah Hudson had 8 receptions this year for 123 yards. 3 of those receptions came against North Texas. He had some injuries in the spring, but never got going. He was behind on the depth chart from a Washington State transfer, Josh Kelly, Caleb Douglas, who left Florida to go to Texas Tech, didn't see a path at Florida, and a sophomore, Coy Eakin. And he barely ever got more than 10 snaps a game. And now he's in the portal. Now, it's not because Joey McGuire didn't do a good job. They won 8 games and do a great job at Texas Tech. But you don't know. And it speaks a little bit to what Coach Prime talks about. Like, hey, man, great recruiting class. Let's check those. Oh, the kid's transferred because he couldn't get on the field. Like, you've got, so you don't know what you're getting. You don't know whether he's going to be great. You don't know if the pressure of being that kid means it's harder for him to just say, I'm working hard, I'm doing my thing. If I was just a 3-star, he might stay, right? But everyone's like, why aren't you playing? Why aren't you playing? I thought you were going to be the greatest player in the world. And he'll go to the SEC or something. He's going to get offers because he's a monster physical talent. But you don't know with this stuff.
No, I brought up a couple of weeks ago where, you know, went through Georgia's freshman class, which has had very little impact. They've had a couple of guys, but their highest rated recruit, Ellis Robinson, defensive back, number 3 player in the class, according to Rivals. He's got 1 solo tackle, 2 assisted tackles, and 8 DNPs. He has mostly not played this year. And that doesn't mean he's a bad player. Some of these guys, it's going to take a while to get on the field. And the expectation now, I think, accelerates. Well, if they're making all that much money, they've got to play. Well, they've still got a depth chart, and you still got more experienced, bigger, stronger people ahead of them at a lot of places. And you can throw them out there to try to justify the expenditure, but it may not go well. So, you know, it's still the money doesn't necessarily change the dynamics of who's ready to play and isn't ready to play.
Yeah, when this is this is a big topic right now, right? Signing day is upon us. The ref share starts in July. And I wrote a story about a month ago ahead of the basketball signing day to kind of get everybody ready of what this looks like with these ref share agreements going out. And I thought I had a great quote in there from one of the CEOs that monitors and is involved with a bunch of different NIL collectives, Jason Belzer. And he was talking about how, you know, you're going to get, these schools are going to get between 12 and 16 million for their football rosters from the rev share, probably. Like, that's around what you're hearing. And his point was, you don't have to spend it all, athletic directors. You don't have to spend it all on football. You don't have to put 12 to 16 million on football if it's not worth it. But everybody else is going to do it, right? So it's kind of like, you know, jump off the bridge, you jump off the bridge, follow everybody, and everybody jumps off the bridge in the water. But the quote was, that's the biggest mistake, he said, that ADs are going to make, is fully funding the sport of football without having the infrastructure to decide how to deploy the dollars and how to do it right. You know, you don't just say, oh, I'm going to fully fund the sport and do it without having some kind of plan and knowing that some of these players, that you better write these contracts in a way where if a player doesn't pan out, you don't have to keep paying them if they stay on your roster. So there's just a lot of changing
they
going on.
They don't think you're about that when they say they want contracts. Coaches never see past move 1. Mm. That's their problem.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know.
That's going to have to start changing. I think we're seeing it this year. We're seeing it change, I think, a little bit. Some schools deciding to keep their coach and not do it. Which, curious, this cycle, Dan, and I know we're going to talk about coaches in a minute, but like the buyouts of the new coaches that are hired, what are these contracts going to look like? Are they going to change? Are they going to be tied in some way to the ref share and all that? You know, yeah. I had an AD yesterday tell me, hey, these coaches are going to have to decide, you want money for yourself and your staff, or you want money for the players,
right? It's a big thing. Like I said, Patrick Mahomes makes more than Andy Reid, and nobody blinks an eye at it. Someday, yeah, that will happen. And you might be quite happy to do that. All right, that was Money Moves presented by Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. We appreciate Invesco's sponsorship of that. All right. Flag planting before we get to the coaching carousel. Flag planting. Rashi wrote about this. A terrific quote. Greg Sankey, commissioner of the SEC. Fantastic. Grade A. This quote's so good, he deserves six teams in the playoffs. I'm starting to believe this.
He'll take it. He'll
if Larry it. Ellison tells me that they need six teams, I will. Whatever you want, Mr. Ellison. Michigan should be in the playoff, presented by Mr. Larry Ellison. The official Michigan booster of the Diag Partners is out. They're come on, man.
tough news for Diag Partners.
They've Custom been Staffing Solutions. You're no longer our favorite possible Michigan sponsor. Custom Staffing Solutions. There shouldn't be flag planting, Greg Sankey said. Go win the game. Go to the locker room. You want to plant a flag? You play capture the flag, or you join the military, or you fly to the moon.
After he delivered that to me, I was like, I was thinking, thank you. But I said, like, can I quote you on this? Can I run this? He's like, yeah, I don't care. All right.
There are occasions when you're doing reporting and someone gives you a quote. And look, Greg Sankey understands the media. This isn't like you're tricking somebody, right?
Yeah.
Like he's he deals with the media all the time, or like lawyers. But even then, somebody, and they give you a quote that's so good, and you're like, this is on the record, right? Like you're almost like stunned. Like this worked. Like, holy, yeah. I can use that. Right. Hell yeah, print it.
Yeah, that was my response.
Put it in the headline. Yeah. All
right.
Yeah.
No, yes, it can actually stall an interview because your mind is going like, oh my God, that's going to be perfect. Oh, that's going to be cool.
Yeah, I don't have any more questions. You know. Just get off the phone, please. Yeah. Anyway, the commissioners, the grand poobahs, are council of elders are upset at the flag planting. What is the latest, Ross?
All right. I don't need it.
It's hard to get them all to agree on something, but they're fired up about this.
Well, right. It's true. They are fired up about it. Yeah, they all are. Three of the four certainly told me, you know, straight up, we need to come to some kind of uniform policy. College football does not have, we all know college football does not have an exclusive governing body that oversees everything.
No one is
the conferences try to work together. They're very fractured. And so this is an issue for a lot of things, including officiating, by the way, which another whole story in general of how college football does need a centralized, organized, some kind of system. It was supposed to always be the NCAA, right? But the NCAA is not involved specifically in football, not involved in the CFP. So for several issues, there is a thought that you need some kind of central governing type of body because the conferences just have trouble agreeing and working together. And this is just another example of it. As they're saying, there needs to, you know, the conferences need to come together and create some uniform rule around post-game field storming, post-game altercations, post-game flag planting, and some kind of penalty structure. Because the conferences, to me, the most interesting part of the story is the conferences themselves have a conflict, Dan, in penalizing for these things, especially in the last game of the regular season, right? Because if they suspend individual players, those players will obviously be suspended for conference championship games. But maybe more importantly, for the conflict part, they'll be suspended for college football playoff games against potentially other conferences with millions of dollars on the line, right? $4 million to each conference for each of their teams that advances a round in the playoff, and $6 million in the last two rounds. So there's a conflict, and we're seeing, right, the Big Ten and the ACC did not suspend individual players. They just fined the schools for some of this stuff.
Yeah, that's there is no way you're going to get conferences to objectively like say, oh, I'm sorry, but Jeremiah Smith got involved in that fracas. He's not playing in the first round of the playoff. Come on. That's not going to happen. And it's
thought we cared about sportsmanship. I thought we cared about. You cannot put a price on sportsmanship, Pat.
Yeah, yeah. There's
or
a price.
Can you?
Mm. Yes, you can. Mm. Yes, you can. Unlike the esteemed Mr. Wetzel, I'm largely on the side of the commissioners here, where I would like to see at least them attempt to address this. And that, to me, there's a visiting team double standard here is what we have got. We've created. We have the field storming stuff has gotten so much attention that we have now, and the onus is on the home team to create a safe exit strategy for the visiting team so they can get off the field immediately after they get their ass kicked. But in the event that the visiting team does the ass kicking, you're apparently allowed to take over the stadium and do whatever the hell you want. You want to cavort around and plant your flag in the middle and mock the home team fans? There's nothing that says you can't. So how about a policy there too? How about a 2-minute exit clock on the field? Saying, yeah, you got 2 minutes to get off the field after the game. Put that thing up there. Or you just simply say, we can't have nice things, and you don't bring your flags on the road. Conference games or whatever. You know what? Leave your flag in the closet at home. Use it for your home games.
Well, but I thought it interesting, Dan, the quote from Sankey. You read the quote from Sankey, but he actually said in the past, because they've had a problem with flag planting in the past, that he's advised his athletic directors to make sure flags are back in the locker room with about 5 minutes to go in the game.
There you go. Because it's a cheerleader flag that they take.
Well, that's, yes, everybody, team. I mean, people seem to really like the flags. I mean, I guess they're good on TV and people cheer and it gives the cheerleaders something to do. But do you really need them?
Well, I'm going to check with Mr. Ellison about my opinion here. see what he has to think first. No, look, first off, I was told that in the NIL era, nobody cares about anything but money and there's no passion in the sport. And these guys are just hired guns. And then here they are. Excited. There's a different. I like the. It doesn't bother me. I think it's funny. I think it's cool. It's fun. Whatever. The issue really isn't the flag planting. Should they get rid of it because it's a headache? Sure, but like these solutions, they have rules on this. They already have rules on this. Nobody wants to enforce their rule. That's the issue. They haven't specifically mentioned flag planting, but I like the passion. I had no problem with Michigan planting the flag. They are fired up. They won the game of their life. I don't care if Mason Graham goes and becomes a Hall of Fame defensive tackle in the NFL and wins 3 Super Bowls. He will always remember that game as one of the greatest moments of his football life. And at the same time, I don't have a big problem. Could you be more humble in your victory? Absolutely. But that's your personal choice. I don't know that you need to legislate that type of stuff. And I also don't have a problem with Ohio State. And you'd say Jack Sawyer, right? He's angry. He's upset. He's frustrated. He doesn't want that flag in his thing. So he goes and confronts it. Should he just sat there and walk off the field and say, look, they beat us. I'm just going to get. Yeah, sure. But I don't have a problem with that passion. Should they be fighting? No, obviously. But they have rules on this stuff. NCAA rule, Section 5, fighting. This is one of the funniest rules I've ever seen. Article 1. This is how it's written. Before the game, squad members in uniform or coaches shall not participate in a fight. During the first half, players should not participate in a fight. During halftime intermission, squad members in uniform or coaches shall not participate in a fight. During the second half, players shall not participate in a fight. I don't know why they listed this off. No mention of after the game. They forgot that one. So technically, you have at it. The Big Ten has a sportsmanship policy. Lord knows they dumped Jim Harbaugh 3 games on this thing last year. Because someone was, he had Connor Stallions had his buddies filming games. He got dumped 3 games. Are we going to, there was a literal fight at the field. Do we think the Big Ten's going to care about sportsmanship when they're all beating on each other? No. No. Jack Sawyer will play. Trust me. But no, and I don't think he shouldn't. I'm saying that. But all of a sudden, sportsmanship doesn't really matter. Big Ten expects all contests involving a member institution to be conducted without compromise to any fundamental element of sportsmanship, integrity, civility towards all, and respect, particularly towards opponents and officials. I don't know. Didn't seem too civil to me. Accordingly, each member institution through the action the group listed, they have the obligation to behave in a way that does not offend the elements of sportsmanship described above, actions that are offensive to the integrity of competition, actions that offend civility, and actions of disrespect are subject to review and punishable in accordance to the terms of this policy. They ain't going to do any of that. They've got a rule.
No. Well, that's the problem with the rule, though, Dan, is just they're, and I'm talking more about the NCAA rule than the Big Ten rule, which is so vague, but the NCAA rule, even if you put in no fighting after the game, too, you're really going to try to get people to enforce this? You know what this turns into? I mean, it turns into 5 days of people poring over video saying, well, Jack Sawyer shoved with a forearm, but he didn't punch. And so he can't get suspended there. And so that's why let's try to avoid the conflict. That's my point. If you can't enforce a no fighting rule, what's the best way? Like, let's try not to have a fight. So take your flags and leave them at home.
They'll find something else.
Yeah, they might. They might.
One of the things couple of the commissioners mentioned to me is, well, this is kind of this up to the school and the coaching staff to control their players, you know, their players and punish their own players, right? But as we know, and Billy Napier of Florida did went out, you know, Billy Napier and Florida aren't in a conference championship game and aren't in the college football playoff, but he did suggest that there will be some suspensions of players who were involved or did this. We'll see. But yeah, the finger often goes on the coaches and the schools in general to enforce these rules themselves, but we often see that not happen.
Yeah, you will sit the first series of the Gasparilla Bowl if you're a Florida player. Congratulations.
That's right. I'll show you.
I'll just say, fighting, like, I'm a big hockey fan, right? And you still get punished. You got to go sit in the penalty box, or particularly egregious, you might get a 10-minute misconduct. And then my favorite rule in all of sports was I think they got rid of it, but was the 3 fights game misconduct in the NHL. So the greatest rule ever. One time you got to beat someone's head in. Yeah, no problem. 5 minutes. A second time, all right, you're pushing it, but we're going to allow it. Third time, forget it. You're just terrible. You're gone. Like, what was the... seems like one should be enough, but no. The flag planting to me is not going to be... You can take the flag out. They'll find something else.
Did you see, Dan, that Sir Big Spur may or may not have pooped on the Clemson midfield paw logo?
I was just pleased to see Sir Big Spur up and about. See, he's doing well. The Gamecock has contributed greatly to our show in the past. It still it should be Cluck Norris. Still a little angry that it's not. But the Cock Commanders, keep that bird healthy, wealthy, and wise and on the field.
Yep. Hope it was a good one. Whatever happened. Feed them all that Taco Bell that Brett Venables ate. Try to before the game. I was told, got a report on that there was actually his daughter had friends with her, so there was many teenagers involved. So
Draft Supremes were dispersed among a large group.
The reports I get after this show is always hysterical.
I do it. I love our audience, man. They come back in with the details.
Yeah, like my brother works at that Taco Bell, and he said, you know, it's like stuff like that. You're like, oh,
yeah.
The reports come in on the taco. Anyway, that happened. All right, we'll be back after this break. Coaching carousel and a couple stories. All right, couple moves in the coaching world. Presented by Larry Ellison of the College Football Inquirer, presented by Larry Ellison. Sam Pittman staying at Arkansas. Another year for the head hog. I think when he got to 6 wins, that might have been assumed. But anyway, he's back officially. I mean, when they got to announce it 2 days before signing day, we're in a weird place. Like, that would have killed old recruiting. North Carolina is still in the running for like a 5-star, and they don't have a coach. That's kind of funny. North Carolina is open. West Virginia is open. UCF is open. And Purdue is open. Those are the four main Power Four jobs. Pat, what do you know? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think you could basically throw out John Sumrall and Barry Odom from Tulane and UNLV, respectively, as potential candidates for everything because they've done a phenomenal job and probably should get another job. Odom is interesting, I think, in regards to West Virginia. He has history with Ren Baker, the AD there. They both worked at Missouri at the same time, 2015-16. But the other interesting candidates there, people whose names have some familiarity in that state, Rich Rodriguez, Jacksonville State coach, who's done phenomenal work everywhere but made two incredibly unfortunate career decisions back in like 2007 when he turned down Alabama, which allowed them to hire Nick Saban, and then when he accepted the job at Michigan, which didn't go well. But he's done very good work everywhere. There's some people that would like to see him come home. Jimbo is a West Virginia native. And the interesting thing, dynamic potentially here, is Ren Baker had to take a lot of blowback from old school West Virginia fans and donors about Bob Huggins. One way to probably get those people, you know, back fully in on your side is hire Rich Rodriguez. If you want an old school guy, West Virginia guy, that would do it. So there's some intrigue with that job.
Yeah, it is. That's maybe the most intriguing, right? If we could see Rich Rod make a return at West Virginia. There was a lot of talk of also another like native son going back to coach West Virginia, Dan. Nick Saban, yeah. Maybe going back to obviously that one not realistic. One of them maybe more realistic, although not happening from what I understand, is the Jimbo Fisher thing too as well. But I don't think we'll see Jimbo Fisher or Nick Saban coach at West Virginia. But Rich Rod and Barry Odom do seem to be the kind of the top names there. And Andy Kotelnicki is the Penn State offensive coordinator. I think he may get a look in there. And then you have North Carolina, which Pat mentioned, John Sumrall, certainly at Tulane. I think there's interest there from a lot of folks, and including maybe North Carolina and him. Matt Campbell, you hear his name as well at Iowa State. Heard his name for a while for different jobs. And maybe this is the year he moves. He hasn't moved at all. Gosh, he's been there, what, nine, 10 years maybe? Seems like forever.
Yeah. I mean, he's the best coach and the winningest coach and the best coach in Iowa State history.
Yeah. So, should be, you know, three of the four jobs probably will be put in the bottom third of power conference football as far as resources and maybe attractiveness. North Carolina is the one that probably is above the others. So we expected a slow, power conference kind of cycle. I think I'd put my over under. I couldn't remember if it was 4.5 or 3.5. I think I said 4.5. So we're already really, really close. Didn't necessarily expect Gus Malzahn, you know, to pop. And I didn't necessarily expect both Purdue and West Virginia. I thought maybe one would go and they both went. So here we sit. And I'm sure we'll have a couple more surprises. Obviously, there's a lot going on in Columbus, as we know.
Yeah, well, there's that, which would change the dynamics in dramatic ways. That would be the tumbling
effect. Call some dominoes, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to get Matt Campbell interested now, he has been quite happy at Ames, but if all of a sudden that one comes calling, but that could be a huge deal. We'll see. We'll keep it posted, but pretty quiet out there. We'll go. All right, a story from the Syracuse 42, Miami 38 victory up at the, not the Carrier Dome, whatever they're calling it now, the Larry Ellison Dome, perhaps, presented by Larry Ellison.
There you go.
Here on the College Football Inquirer, presented by Larry
the
Ellison.
The funny thing about people, can I say, the funny thing about people, like, quibbling with calling it the Carrier Dome, it's always the Carrier Dome to anybody that, like, isn't really, like, wonky about corporate naming. It'll always be called the Carrier Dome.
Kind of weird thing to get excited about. Like, there's certain passions I don't like. I'm not a comic book guy, but I get it. If you're a comic book guy, okay, that's what they like. Like, I'm really passionate about corporately sponsored stadiums. Remember when in LA they did a retirement for the Staples Center because they changed to the crypto arena? It was like the building's not arena. It's like the building's going down. Like it's the Boston Garden. It's the same building.
I know. Yeah.
I'm really passionate about properly identifying my corporate sponsorship deals. Obviously it's a big win for Syracuse, a big loss for Miami, but this was not the only L that the Miami program took that day. Reports came out via Ashley Wenskowski. She is a television reporter for CNY in Central New York. And she put out on social media during the game, quote, Sebastian the Ibis, which is the Miami mascot, Sebastian the Ibis. Sebastian the Ibis just kneeled down and asked for my number mid-drive.
Go, Sebastian.
Sebastian shooting a shot on Ashley, the television reporter, mid-game. Yeah. Ashley unimpressed, both in Sebastian in general and his timing. Quote, feels like he has bigger things to worry about with his team on the ropes in the fourth quarter at the Dome. But who am I to say? So we had a mascot hitting on a television reporter. That is the ACC. That just means more. Syracuse fans flocked to Ashley's defense, of course, in support of her, and said, "Not defense. I don't. She's the one who brushed the dude away. Poor Sebastian." Said they didn't have Miami was unfocused even on their mascot, all sorts of lines. Apparently Ibis didn't see that Fansville where the mascot hucks the Dr. Pepper, no sugar Dr. Pepper through the window. And then the girl goes, that's why you're a mascot. Even Sebastian can't pull a television reporter. I thought on knee though. That was very polite. Sebastian has responded on social media. He said, they do anything for clout, end quote.
All right.
Oh, God.
Pat, is this proper behavior by a mascot? People's court.
Yes. I mean, considering I would deem the mascot non-essential personnel during a drive. Like, you're not involved, all right? If the drive ends in the end zone and then you feel the need to jump around and do Ibis things, fine. But until the ball's in the end zone, you're just watching like everybody else. And if you kind of like the look of the TV reporter and you're standing there, you take your shot. You get down, on one, what I guess their legs, Ibises have legs, right? They're like claws. They have claw feet. I don't know. And I mean, I don't even know where you take the number. Do you like... You don't have hands to write. You can't write down the number. What do you do? Do you have your phone on you somewhere in the uniform?
He's a college kid. He always has a phone on him. Yeah,
that's true.
Sure, there's a phone somewhere.
Good point. So maybe a list logistically a little wonky, but I have no problem with the timing or the effort. Good job.
Also, this Ashley, right? Is that her name?
Ashley, I believe.
Yeah, Ashley. She doesn't really know. Right. I mean, the guy's in a furry, basically. So we need to take off. Right. Doesn't he need to take off the hat, the top, the head, whatever, and see how he looks before she makes a ruling on this? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he should de-furry himself, if that's a word.
He's a college. Presumably he's an undergrad. Ashley's there. He's smitten. He's probably like, it'd be very nerve wracking, right? Asking a young lady out is very nerve wracking. So
he was using it as a shield.
He's got the head on there and he can't be seen. So his disappointment, I say go for it. Sure. Don't miss, I think Pat's right. Don't miss a touchdown. He tried. I don't know where he thought this relationship was going, like long distance. I mean, he has wings. his wings. Maybe he could fly up there. Take it, yeah, flattery. Like this man lives in Coral Gables and he's interested in you.
Yeah, right. You know,
so
nice place to go for the winter.
Ibis got smacked on the beak or whatever they call it. Not good. Now they're on the playoff bubble. So this is where they're at. Thanks for watching and listening. Thanks again to Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA.